This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Carnivore Club. Carnivore Club is a cured meat of the month club that delivers meat right to your door. Makes a great Christmas present, especially for hard to buy people. They send you meat from artisans from across the country. They make stuff out of boar, ostrich, just stuff that you would never think of, but it tastes fantastic. Head over to carnivoreclub.co and use my promo code AOM at checkout for 15% off. Again, that's carnivoreclub.co. Use my promo code AOM at checkout for 15% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, it's Christmas time, trees are up, stockings are hung, and you've likely seen Santa Claus a dozen or so times already. While many Christmas traditions have ancient roots, Christmas culture as we know it today is a modern creation, and most of that genesis happened in New York City, the Big Apple, over a century ago. My guest today on the show wrote a book that explores the development of Christmas in New York City by looking at a 1920s con man who used the story of Santa Claus to swindle hundreds of thousands of dollars from generous New Yorkers. The author of the book is Alex Palmer, and his book is The Santa Claus Man, The Rise and Fall of a Jazz Age Con Man, and the Invention of Christmas in New York. And today on the show, Alex and I discuss what Christmas looked like before the 19th century and the famous New Yorkers who helped turn Christmas into what it is today. Against that backdrop, we discuss the life and times of John Gluck, a PR man who started an organization that answered letters written to Santa Claus, but in the process, lined his pockets with hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's also a story that sidetracks to a story that involves a bitter rivalry between the Boy Scouts of America and another scouting organization that consisted of rifle-toting 12-year-olds. You don't want to miss this holiday edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. It's going to give you lots of fodder to talk about at Christmas dinner. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/Santa Claus Man. Alex Palmer, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me.
All right. You wrote a book called The Santa Claus Man, The Rise and Fall of a Jazz Age Con Man and the Invention of Christmas in New York. And I was telling you earlier, before we started recording, that this is probably the funnest history book I've read in a long time, because it has Christmas. It's seasonal. It's December now, and it involves all these missing bits, like these forgotten bits of American history that still have an influence on American culture today. I mean, we got Santa Claus, the way we celebrate Christmas, Boy Scouts make an appearance in this. So it's a lot of fun, and it all centers around this caper story involving a guy named John Gluck who used Santa Claus to line his pockets from and generous New Yorkers. How did you, before we get into like the details of Gluck, and we'll get to what he did specifically, but how did you find out about this guy and what he did?
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting story in itself. John Gluck is actually a relative of mine. He's a great granduncle who I didn't really know much about till a couple years back. It was actually on Christmas Eve. We were sitting around with our family, and my uncle had mentioned that we had this relative that had been, he didn't know a lot of details, but he had been Santa Claus. He had answered Santa letters in New York, and that was about all he knew. And that seemed like a fun story. I thought maybe it'd be worth just learning for myself, or maybe there'd be a fun article or something. So I did a little digging and found out that we had this figure in our family who had started a group that answered Santa letters and had really become something of a jazz age celebrity in New York. A lot of newspaper articles about him, a lot of coverage and celebrities that worked with him. But then as I started digging more, I realized there was a lot more to the story, a lot of darker aspects to what he was doing and what sort of was discovered about the seemingly warm-hearted charitable work that he was set on. And that's when I realized there was a great potential for a book here.
Right. So we'll get into the seedier parts of Gluck's story later on, but let's set some background for this, because he used Santa Claus as sort of the ruse for his con. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about your book and what I found fascinating was pretty much what we think of as Christmas today and how we conceptualize Santa Claus today. It was invented in New York City. During like the late all the way from the beginning of the early 19th century to the end. Can you walk us through briefly the evolution of Santa from the moment he arrived in New York at the beginning of the 19th century, or, you know, late 18th century, to how he became the big, fat, jolly guy in the red suit?
The familiar guy we know. And that's, like you were saying, it was actually a surprise to me too, as I started reading it, just as I was learning about my own relative, these interesting backstories. Santa himself, sort of this character I thought I knew, I thought was this timeless figure that just was imported from Europe and caught on here, and maybe Coca-Cola had helped invent. I sort of had these different assumptions about the character. Once I started digging, it did turn out he's really a New York invention. But he really did start kind of at the beginning of the 19th century in New York. It was sort of a handful of figures of writers and kind of patrician leaders in the city who were getting frustrated with the way Christmas was being celebrated in the city. And they wanted to, they sort of, there was this, the figure of St. Nicholas had kind of been floating around. It was a familiar character, but it was really Washington Irving, the author you know more familiarly as the writer of Legend of Sleepy Hollow or Rip Van Winkle. He wrote this sort of satirical history called The History of New York that was more like just kind of a comedy book that took pieces of true facts about New York history, characters that were actually figures in the history, and then added a lot of his own kind of comedic wit to it. And one of the additional characters he had in it was St. Nicholas, who he presented as being this major figure in the early Dutch settlers' culture. They worshipped St. Nicholas. He was on the bow of the first ship that came into harbor in New York, according to Washington Irving's telling of it, and that he was this guy who rode around on a wagon over rooftops, dropping gifts to children. So this was in 1809, and this was really the first time St. Nicholas was being discussed in this way as this kind of mythical, fun figure. Prior to that, he was really he was a saint. He was associated with the Catholic Church, but he didn't have these sort of fun elements in the way that that Washington Irving introduced. And that was kind of one of the earliest, what really kind of foundational moment of Santa Claus in the U.S. And that book was immensely popular. That version of St. Nicholas was widely discussed and became this sort of figure that became well known and became the sort of a new version of the character that hadn't really existed prior to that. And so his work combined with, there was another man named John Pintard who was one of the founders of the New York Historical Society. And he had also kind of had this interest in the New York past, in its Dutch founders and the culture surrounding it. And he had made his own effort to kind of bring St. Nicholas, this sort of cult of St. Nicholas, to America and to New York, and kind of took a very different approach of talking about the sort of noble aspects of St. Nick and these ideas of him, his generosity and those sort of points. He tried to bring back the celebration of St. Nicholas Day on December 6th, and this just sense of St. Nick as this cultural sort of godfather to the city. He actually tried to get him to be instituted as the patron saint of New York. So kind of both this, it was 1809 that Washington Irving's book came out, and it was 1810 that John Pintard kind of instituted this St. Nicholas Day feast celebration and created a woodcut of the character. It was the first time you actually had an image of St. Nicholas in New York City or in the U.S. at all. So those kind of two things then got the ball rolling with St. Nick. But he was still kind of a ecclesiastical figure, the sort of church, you know, more affiliated with the saint part than before he was really a Santa Claus. And it took really a few other developments, particularly Clement Clark Moore wrote that poem that, you know, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" and "All Through the House." And that came out in 1821. And that really, in all this, so many elements of Santa Claus that we know now grew out of that poem. And he was really, when he wrote that poem, kind of cherry picking different elements of the character that had been introduced by Irving and Pintard and a couple other writers. And he really got the ball rolling on Santa. So by the time it was, you know, early 1820s, you had that version of Santa Claus really starting to be seen. And it took a few other figures up. Thomas Nast, who is an illustrator for Harper's, drew for years. He would draw these illustrations of Santa in that magazine every Christmas, and it became one of the most popular, you know, it was a widely read magazine, and that was what sort of solidified the final image of Santa Claus. And that was around like the 1860s, 1870s. And so then from that point, that was really where the modern Santa Claus image was created.
Right. And then also, I thought it was interesting, like the history of writing letters to Santa. That took some time.
Yeah, it also developed over time. And around the same time, it was really the 1800s, when it first, you know, early 1820s, where Santa really had started as this kind of disciplinary ecclesiastical figure. Santa letters too kind of started in this didactic way, where really the earliest letters were written from Santa to children. These parents writing to their kids about, "You've done this really well during the year, but I think you should be doing this," and just judging them on their behavior, what they, you know, the goods and bads, kind of this voice of God they would be creating for their children. And there would be these lessons in there and little, you know, requests for how they should behave in the next year. But then over time, that shifted as well, with figures like Thomas Nast drawing illustrations of Santa answering his letters, with developments in the postal service where it became easier for kids to actually write a letter and drop it in the mail and it would actually be sent out. It started to catch on, and you had a lot more kids writing to Santa. You had kids being more open about requesting gifts. And this was about around the time when, you know, mass production was becoming more common. So it would go from asking for things like apples or, you know, little homemade gifts to asking for a specific, you know, doll or a specific toy that they wanted that they could buy at the department store. And soon these letters were really piling up.
Right. Now that'll lead us to John Gluck and what he did. But besides Santa, like the way we just celebrate Christmas in America, was pretty much New York City too. You know, for example, we often, Christmas is this very domestic, family-oriented holiday where you just sit with your family and, you know, you maybe get together as a community to do these community things. But it wasn't always like that in America. How did people celebrate Christmas in America in the early days, and how did New York City change that?
Yeah. Christmas had really kind of gone back and forth in the way it was celebrated. I like to think of it as kind of going from outdoor to indoor and back again. Going way back, it had started really as this pagan festival to celebrate the end of the harvest. The church kind of co-opted that in, like, I think it was like the 4th century, where they then made that officially Christmas and tried to make it more of a religious holiday. And there was a lot of tension about that back and forth. So you always had these tensions where it was the church trying to create a more spiritual holy day, and these pagan roots that kept coming back up, where it was a time to party. You'd done all the work for the year, you had all this food and drink, so you're going to enjoy it. And in New York, kind of during the early 1800s, really that was when the outdoor celebration, sort of pagan roots, were on full display, where when people would celebrate Christmas, it was just going into the streets, partying. They would sing, drink, be shooting off guns and fireworks. It was just this, maybe closer to what you see as celebrating New Year's, but much more anarchy, where it would just be, you know, this wild partying that would be happening in the streets. And that obviously didn't sit well with a lot of the town elders or the, you know, the upper classes, a lot of these people partying were the working class and the people who didn't have that many opportunities to blow off steam. The upper class really preferred to celebrate New Year's. They would have more quiet time in their homes. They might visit with friends, go, you know, from one house to the other and say hello. But the real party on Christmas Day was these sort of lower castes and the more wealthy and the elite wanted to see a shift happen in the holiday. And that's where you had folks like John Pintard and others, Clement Clark Moore. They really started to encourage this celebration of Christmas as a family holiday and moving it indoors again. And even with maybe less religious connection than it had in some of its earlier versions, but they really made it a family holiday. And that corresponded with the time when formal police groups were being created, so they could actually start enforcing these laws and put a stop to the drunken madness happening on the streets. And it really ended up shifting the holiday into the house, where people, if they were going to celebrate Christmas, it would be with their family, with parents giving gifts to kids, rather than say, the party or the, you know, the newspaper boy who was, you know, demanding tips from his customers, which is what it had been before.
And I mean, also things like Christmas trees became popular in New York City. I mean, I'm sure Christmas trees were being used by American immigrants throughout America, but like in New York City, like the idea of like a Christmas tree lot where he would go and buy a Christmas tree, that started in New York City too.
Yeah, that's right. And that was around 1850s, as you were saying. It had been sort of, there had been sort of this tradition of Christmas trees from some of the German immigrants, and it was being done, but not really on a large scale basis until there started to be more newspapers covering this practice, especially after Prince Albert in England brought that to when he married Victoria. He brought that practice into England, and then that was covered in American papers, and people started to catch on to that. So it was in New York City where the market for it became clear. People were starting to want those Christmas trees. And there was a merchant in New York who had the idea of, well, why don't I? He was living up in the upstate New York, where he had a lot, where he just had all these evergreen trees that he didn't know what to do with. He had struck on the idea of, well, why don't I go down to the city and sell these? And he did. I think it was 1851 was the first year he went down and just opened up a little shop on the corner of the Washington Market, and immediately sold out. And from that point on, Christmas tree farms became a staple in the city and in New York, and then throughout the United States.
Right, and then we see the merging of commercialism with Christmas in New York City too, like the F.W. Woolworth Company. Huge in making Christmas decorations popular.
Yeah, and it followed a similar pattern as the Christmas tree market, where it was something that, you know, had been done kind of informally. People might make their own ornaments or candles lighted, you know, actual ignited candles were very popular for a while. So also there, every, you know, day after Christmas, there'd be reports of these homes burning, or the fire department would have to be on high alert because so much of that, you know, where these trees would just go up. As it was so much else around Christmas, there was a clear market there that figures like F.W. Woolworth saw. He was the one who founded the Five and Dime store and really kind of created the idea of a department store for people that didn't have a ton of money. He had a lot of inexpensive things that he would sell, and this made Christmas ornaments very affordable. He saw the opportunity here of really, you know, doubling down on Christmas. He partnered with these glass makers in Germany who made these special Christmas ornaments. So he would sell those and first kind of did a test run the first year, and they immediately sold out. And soon that became one of his biggest sellers each year. And that really kind of pioneered what now we have with, you know, Black Friday on, where, say, you know, Christmas decorations, Christmas gifts have become just such a huge part of the holiday. But that really originated in that time frame around the late 1800s.
Yeah. All right. So this brings us back to John Gluck and his Santa Claus association. So we have this sentimental, we have this idea of Christmas being very sentimental, this idea of Santa, who is a jolly guy. He's not disciplinarian, but he's there to give gifts to children. And Gluck had this idea of answering letters from poor New Yorkers, children, to fulfill their Christmas wishes. So let's talk about, like, why was, what happened to these letters before Gluck decided, I'm going to be the guy to answer them?
Yeah, yeah. So these letters, as, you know, children were writing them, they started getting more and more stacking up, where they would put them in the mailbox and they would go to the post office. Obviously, there wasn't a Santa Claus that they could actually deliver them to. So generally, either the post office would pass them off to newspapers, and they would sometimes publish the letters, or occasional groups would volunteer to take them. But the law was that if a letter came that couldn't be delivered to a recipient, they were supposed to go to the dead letter office and be destroyed. So that's what would end up happening with most of these letters. There was some back and forth with, they tried to change the rules, or there was a lot of protests from different, both, you know, different private groups and individuals, and even the New York Times weighed in saying the post office should really release these letters put a lot of pressure on the post office to do something about all these Santa letters. There was this outcry that all these children's wishes are just being ignored and destroyed, and this just seemed like a tragedy for sometimes tens of thousands of kids who just weren't getting, you know, we're having these innocent letters just go to the garbage. So the post office finally relented. There was enough pressure put on them that in 1912, they changed the rule. And they said, all right, on a local level, if any city's postmaster wants to give these letters to a charitable group that's interested in answering them, or even an individual, they can do that. It's you know, up to the postmaster's discretion, and it depends on if there's somebody or a group that's willing to answer these letters, but we will you know, grant them. So this was a very popular decision once this was made. It got a lot of attention. People were excited that Santa's letters were going to be answered. But in the biggest city in the country, nobody really came forward. There was still thousands of children's letters that were going to the New York post office and just having to end up at the dead letter office. In 1912, nobody came forward to claim them. So they just ended up getting destroyed. And that's where John Gluck saw an opportunity. He was reading these stories about all these letters and thought this might be a worthwhile project to undertake. Prior to that, he had been this press agent and publicist and working as a customs broker, where it was this job that he had inherited from his dad. He's been working for the family company, doing things he wasn't very particularly interested in. So he really moved into more work as this publicist, trying to generate interest in for clients, and started getting good with creating press contacts and getting news into, you know, about various events or, you know, different, you know, business opportunities and things like that. He would get the press to cover. So he thought, well, his combination of business savvy and ability to generate press, combine that with this idea of answering Santa letters, and it was just too irresistible of an opportunity for him. So he founded this group in 1913 called the Santa Claus Association, requested the letters from the postmaster, who granted it to him. And so in 1913, this was the first year that New York City's children's Santa letters would be answered.
And did he start off like with sincere intentions? Like he thought, like, we could do something good here? Or was he looking at it as like, this could actually help me out some way?
From what I can tell, it certainly seems like he had some good intentions. Obviously, if he was somebody just out to make a quick buck, this was not the easiest way to do that. He took a lot of steps, made a real show of verifying that these letters, the way he set up the association and kind of what set it apart from efforts to answer Santa letters in the past, was he wouldn't actually handle any of the gifts or any donations himself. And he made a major point of that when he first founded the group. He had a lot of volunteers that would help out. And all it really did, it was more of a clearinghouse for these letters, where the postman would give the Santa Claus Association this stack of Santa letters. Gluck and his volunteers would then send these letters out to individuals who volunteered to receive them, or just people who he'd gotten their names, and maybe prominent members of society, Vanderbilts and others, and would just send them these Santa letters. They would then get that, and they could answer that on their own. So you'd get a letter from Johnny asking for, you know, a toy truck, and you personally could either mail that gift to Johnny and say it was from Santa, or you could even go yourself to visit and hand him the gift. So the Santa Claus Association was just there to route those requests. They weren't accepting gifts. They weren't accepting money, or so it was when he first founded and started the group. But this idea really did catch on, and whatever Gluck's motivations, it certainly, there were people answering these letters. There were thousands of kids that ended up receiving gifts as a result of it. So it certainly had a positive impact right out the gate. Whether it was a purely from innocent motives was not totally clear.
So, I mean, what sort of tactics did he use to gin up support for the Santa Claus Association? Because I mean, it seems like a lot of the reason why it caught on, because like Gluck had a real knack for promoting. Like he had a skill for it.
Yeah, he really did. And it's fascinating to look at, because 1913, the group started, but it ended up running for 15 years. And it's fascinating to see sort of how his own strategies evolved over that time. The first year, it was really about, he got a ton of press coverage, but it was more the novelty of it that got a lot of attention. So he would, just the idea that Santa's letters were going to be answered got a lot of attention in the press. And you could really see his skills as a publicity man at work. He was able to get coverage in every major New York newspaper, even nationally, people were writing about it. But then the next year, the novelty wears off, so he has to come up with other ways to keep it relevant. And this is the same year that World War I begins. So he initiates this whole campaign of, we're not only going to be answering kids' wishes for Santa, but we're going to be encouraging these children to pray for peace. And he even wrote to the president to try to get him to make a break in the war, for at least on Christmas Day. So that also got a lot of attention. And then he starts reaching out to Broadway stars and stars of the theater, and they, working with John Barrymore and another of the producers on Broadway, they actually host a benefit show, all for the Santa Claus Association. All the money that people pay on, I think it was like December 22nd show, all that money goes to help pay for postage and other supplies for the Santa Claus Association. Soon then movie stars, he's getting involved. At the time, it was all just silent films. But he each year finds new schemes to get a lot of attention. Politicians were getting involved, as well as different kind of public figures like that, leaders of business. And he was always sure to, as soon as he got support from somebody, the word would get out to the press right away about this new person that's either going to be answering a letter to Santa or is coming to the Santa Claus Association headquarters to help answer them. And he just always kept the group in the headlines that way.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, no matter where you are in life, there's always something new to learn. That's why I'm such a big fan of the Great Courses Plus. With the Great Courses Plus, you'll get unlimited access to stream an extensive library of courses on so many topics like history, business, philosophy, even how to play chess, how to take better pictures, how to eat better, meditation, you name it, they got it. They're all taught by award-winning professors and experts in their fields, and new courses are added all the time, so there's always something new to learn. It's what I listen to whenever I'm dropping my kid off at school. One course I recommend you check out right now when you sign up at the Great Courses Plus is Life Lessons from the Great Books, taught by a professor that I had at the University of Oklahoma, Professor J. Rufus Fears. Really great series of lectures. And right now, I got a special offer for our podcast listeners. Just head over to thegreatcoursesplus.com/manliness, and you'll get an entire month of unlimited access for free. Again, thegreatcoursesplus.com/manliness to get one free month of unlimited access to the Great Courses Plus. Also by Sherry's Berries. Christmas is just days away, and all the stores are going to be packed with last-minute holiday shoppers, but luckily you don't have to battle the crowds to get the perfect gift. Sherry's Berries offers a variety of juicy berries dipped in tempting white chocolate, milk, or dark chocolatey goodness and topped with your choice of decorative swizzles, chocolate chips, or chopped nuts. They're really good. The berries are fantastic. I got a sample and they're delicious. Everyone in the family loves them. Sherry's Berries is the one-stop shop for everyone on your list. And now you can get half a dozen freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries starting at only just $19.99 plus shipping. That's over a 30% savings, or double the berries for just $10 more. And here's how you get this offer. Just go to berries.com, click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner, and type in the code manliness. Again, that's berries, berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in code manliness to get a dozen dipped berries for just $19.99. Go check it out. And now back to the show.
Okay. So we got to take a quick detour here. Because while he was doing the Santa Claus Association, Gluck got involved in a bit of forgotten American history that involves Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's not just the Boy Scouts of America. He was involved with the group. I didn't know this. I didn't know at the very beginning of the scout movement, there were different scouting organizations competing with each other. And it got pretty, cutthroat of how competitive they were trying to capture young boys, their attention. Mm-hmm. But he was involved with a group called the United States Boy Scout. Can you tell us a bit about this group and what made it different from the BSA?
Yeah, and it's similar to learning about Santa. It was the same thing with the Boy Scouts, where it's like once you start digging, you're like, oh, there's a fascinating backstory. And just as Gluck changed his promotional tactics for the Santa Claus Association each year and found new ways to generate interest in it, he also was always looking for new ideas, because obviously the Santa Claus Association, it really only became active December 1st and lasted for that month. So he had 11 other months he was trying to work, and he kind of patched together different odd jobs. But what he found most profitable was working as a promoter in this way for sort of noble causes. And he saw the success the Santa Claus Association had. So then he saw this opportunity with a group called the United States Boy Scout, which when the Boy Scouts of America were founded, it was this import from England, and this idea that sort of a paramilitaristic idea of that young boys should be trained and learn to learn good character, good citizenship, that sort of thing. But the more militaristic version in England, when it was imported to the U.S., a lot of that was kind of dropped. So it was much more just about being a good citizen and finding ways to sort of show your civic pride, helping old ladies cross the street and that sort of thing. But within months of when the Boy Scouts of America, which is what still is around today that we know, within months of when it was founded, this other group called the United States Boy Scout was created. And that was actually sort of to fill the gap of that militaristic element of the group, where the Boy Scouts of America was not militaristic. The United States Boy Scout really embraced that the idea of military, and that we're training the children to fight in the wars eventually. So they would have things like drills, like military drills, where they would actually go out and do these mock battles. And They ended up running into trouble early on. Not only did the Boy Scouts of America kind of organize quickly and start trying to put pressure on these rival groups to shut down, but the United States Boy Scout also because of the use of rifles, they had a couple incidents early on where some of the members would shoot each other. And there was actually a couple deaths that happened because of the sort of freewheeling and gun-toting nature of these United States Boy Scouts. So the group took a hit and really fell out of, you didn't hear much about them. And that's when Gluck saw an opportunity there that he could kind of use this group as could kind of help promote it and do something more with it, that it was still around, but just had lost a lot of membership and a lot of interest. So he then sort of at first joined the group as a fundraiser, and then slowly rose up the ranks as he got more and more effective at helping to promote it and to get, there would be kind of playing a lot of the similar heartstrings that the Santa Claus Association would, but where the Santa Claus Association appealed to, people's sense of, the holidays and those sort of sentimentality, the United States Boy Scout, he really aimed at their patriotism and said, you know, donate to our group, and we're helping to train these kids to become, you know, good, you know, fighters and good citizens. And so this became a success for him. He ended up raising quite a bit of money, and in the process, not necessarily being clear with the people who were donating that this was a separate group from the Boy Scouts of America. There were many checks that were sent to them thinking that they were the Boy Scouts of America, but that actually they didn't realize this was going to a separate organization.
And Gluck was also, he was getting a finder's fee, right? He was getting like 40%, mm-hmm. whatever money he raised.
Yeah, exactly. 40% on top of a salary, and all he was, and even that, it wasn't being very carefully accounted for. So that was at minimum what he was bringing in on this. And this is, you know, substantial amounts of money that people would donate, especially as this was, you know, when World War I was really kicking into full gear. So people were really cutting checks to patriotic efforts. And this was a great opportunity for him. So he used it.
And it seems like his involvement with the United States Boy Scout, I mean, that seems like that's where he sowed the seeds for his self-destruction with the Santa Claus Association. I mean, what happened with his involvement with the United States Boy Scout that it affected how he did work with the Santa Claus Association?
Yeah, so he, you know, had these different schemes going on, and the most prominent being the Santa Claus Association and this United States Boy Scout. But yeah, the difference of Santa Claus Association, it wasn't getting that much scrutiny because there was no one else answering Santa letters. So people were happy to kind of let it run and do what it was doing. There wasn't a lot of questioning about how it was doing this or double checking the process to make sure that the money was going where Gluck said it was going. But the United States Boy Scout had a very prominent rival in the Boy Scouts of America, and they were not happy to see what the United States Boy Scout was doing. So they, James West in particular, who's sort of the chief executive of the Boy Scouts of America, really went hard after Gluck and the U.S. Boy Scout. And it took years of them kind of battling back and forth, where first it was these efforts just to, you know, inform the public that this is not a real organization on the same level of the Boy Scouts of America, that it was falsely advertising the number of members it had. It was using names of prominent donors and honorary executives and giving out all this information that was not true. A lot of the times these prominent people didn't even realize that they were being affiliated with this other group. So the Boy Scouts of America first tried to get this information out there. When that didn't totally work, they finally just tried to shut down the United States Boy Scout. Eventually, it went up to the Supreme Court, and they succeeded in getting Gluck to no longer use the term Boy Scout in the group's name. He tried to keep it going under a couple different names, but really once that decision had come down that he couldn't use the name, that pretty much killed that effort, and it also really exposed Gluck in a way that he hadn't been before. It showed so many elements that things like the honorary vice presidents, the fundraising questions, and all of those elements that were going on in the Santa Claus Association, but because it had been exposed so fully with the Boy Scouts scandal, it created some problems for him with the Santa Claus Association, and he ended up, because he was sort of been totally walloped in the decision with the Boy Scouts, he sort of backed off the Santa Claus Association for a couple years, and this was around 1918, I believe. So it was right around then that he ended up having to kind of pull back from being the city's Santa Claus.
But he eventually licked his wounds and came back to it, and came back to it with a lot of energy. But something changed in the way he approached the Santa Claus Association. What was that change?
Yeah. And it was really kind of making himself less of a prominent role. For the first 5 years of the group, whenever it would be promoted, it was always, he was the Santa Claus man. He was the center of the group. It was his business genius and charitable, mind that created the group. It was always him in the headlines. But when he returned to the work, because even though he tried to step away from it, he actually went after the Boy Scout scandal, he tried to give pass the work off to the Salvation Army. They refused. They had enough else going on that they couldn't really take it on. So he tried to not work with the Santa Claus Association anymore after that point, but the letters kept coming and he was still the only person who had authority to answer them. So they kept going to him. So he kind of couldn't help but still be involved, but then he shifted his role where he became more of a background figure. He tapped folks like Samuel Brill, who was a prominent businessman, a major retailer, owner of Brill Brothers, became the figurehead and would speak to the press about the group's work. And then even celebrities like Doug Fairbanks and Mary Pickford became major spokespeople for the group and helped to launch it in its 1923 season. So in all of those stories, Gluck wasn't mentioned, and he really took a back seat. But the work of the Santa Claus Association just got bigger. More letters were coming, bigger names were being associated with it. And it's fascinating to look at it compared to what happened with the Boy Scouts, where once the reality of what was going on behind the scenes of the Boy Scouts was exposed, that fell apart pretty quickly. The Santa Claus Association really kept outliving, the exposure and things that would have killed a different organization. But because of its connection to Santa and the holidays, it proved really hard to, call into question.
So, I mean, how was Gluck, doing the con? Because, I mean, part of the thing that made Santa Claus Association different, it was just a clearinghouse. We just took letters. And then the people, we didn't touch gifts, we didn't touch money. Like, the only money we used was for postage, but like, he was making money from this. What was he that allowed him to line his pockets?
Yeah, and that's where things started shifting pretty quick. The first year, it was all about we were just a clearinghouse. We don't ever touch any of this stuff. But then by the next year, he was asking for donations to cover postage. And then it was that he created a gift buying committee within the group that would, if you send us money, we'll do the work of buying these gifts for the children. And then he put out every year this Santa Claus annual that was really like a beautiful brochure about all the work that they would do, with all the photos of the prominent the society ladies and men of industry who were involved in the group. And he would get advertisers to advertise in it and charge them. And he would charge to buy the Santa Claus annual, which all the members would obviously want to do because it had them so flatteringly displayed in there. So he kept coming up with new ways to raise money, despite having initially created the group saying, we won't touch money. This is all volunteer driven. It started shifting. And he saw these opportunities. He saw how much generosity was produced during the holiday season, how happy people were to try to contribute to this. And he couldn't help himself, it seemed. And so he started coming up with one scheme after another, where the work of answering the children's letters was still happening, but there were all these satellite money-making schemes that were being built up around it. And most of that money was not being accounted for. And there weren't many more people than Gluck who were profiting from it.
And how did I think the way you describe in the book seems like philanthropic work in the early 20th century was very laissez-faire. There wasn't a lot of regulation. That started to change right around the time that the Santa Claus Association got going. How did these new regulations or new policing of charitable organizations, how did that lead to the downfall of the Santa Claus Association?
Yeah, because it really, charitable giving was really, it was kind of a wild west. There was just a lot of groups asking for money. There wasn't much formal regulation of it. And after World War I, that's when you saw charity as an industry really grow. That's when it really became a formal industry as we know now, with things like the Red Cross and other major charitable organizations. And Gluck took advantage of that. That there was still no formal policing. Things like if you didn't have to keep a lot of records, if you could just prove that even part of your money. It could even just be a negligible percent if that went to the charitable work and most of the other money went to the solicitors who got the money, then you couldn't really be prosecuted. The DA actually had tried to go after Gluck, but didn't have much luck making anything stick for those reasons. The laws just weren't there. But things shifted in New York City. Particularly, there was a public welfare commissioner who took over starting in 1918 and really made it his mission. He had previously been sort of the accountant of the city, and it was all about, you know, making sure that all trying to make sure that, you know, no money was going to waste, and was happy to, you know, cut off groups that seemed like they weren't deserving of charity. So he started cracking down on things like peddlers in the street that were claiming they were with veterans groups or there to help children in the war effort and those kind of things. He would crack down on their efforts or require them to have some sort of permit to do that. And he did other sort of centralizing of charity efforts throughout the city, so that instead of it just being this hodgepodge of different individuals and organizations that no one could really verify, there was really this formal citywide organization that would be overseeing things. And Gluck didn't want any part of that for a lot of reasons. And he really presented it as a sense of that it shouldn't have this kind of bureaucratic control. That was one of his big selling points of the Santa Claus Association to begin with. It wasn't about top down this, you know, massive organization arranging for donations. It was about individuals answering kids' letters. And he kind of sold that as more formality and formalizing was happening of the charity groups. He was saying, well, Santa Claus Association doesn't need to do that. We're about the individuals being able to answer these children's letters. And that public welfare commissioner soon enough got wind of what Gluck was doing and kind of the suspicions around what he was doing, and then started to take a closer look at the Santa Claus Association.
And I mean, Gluck also used just the sentimental feelings that people had about Santa Claus.
Yeah. I mean, people love the idea, and they still do now, you know, the idea of answering Santa's letters every year, in New York. There's the New York City post office answers Santa letters, and people are always like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that they do that. And it's sort of a new discovery each December.
Do you know how much money Gluck made during this long con?
It's hard to say because he did not keep super strict records, but as much as a quarter million potentially, but as low as maybe just, you know, 10,000-20,000, but he certainly was generating a lot of money. But he was able to keep it all kind of shady in a way that it was impossible to really get an exact figure. And that's what made him so, you know, slippery for these, for when any kind of authorities tried to prosecute or to get a closer look at what they were doing. It was difficult because the records were sort of misleading, or he would have information that didn't really say exactly how much was coming in or exactly how it was being used.
I mean, so what do you think about, what do you think Gluck's legacy is? I mean, he did take advantage. He made a lot of money unethically by taking advantage of Santa Claus. But at the same time, he was a Christmas booster. He was a Santa Claus booster. Do we have something to thank to Gluck for, you know, the way we think of Christmas today?
I think so. And he was the first to, in New York, to answer Santa letters at this scale and to give it this kind of attention after, even, you know, as he was exposed. And it was 1928 when he finally, sort of his downfall, and the book kind of outlines, you know, how that came about. It took some doing even as he was being exposed. It was still difficult to really pull the letters from him because of the quirky rules of the post office. But once he finally was had this revoked, the letters still came in and were still answered, and the post office ended up creating its own organization, Operation Santa Claus, which still operates today, kind of in as a result of what Gluck had done, and it still has a lot of similar elements to the kind of executive approach that he had used, where it's the careful organization of numbering letters and matching them to the donors and having more direct contact between the donors and the givers. And so many elements of what the Santa Claus Association did and Gluck's innovations with that are still in practice today. You can go to the same post office that he went to, the Farley post office on 8th Avenue, and go in there today and get letters to Santa to answer. So that legacy still lives on, and that and obviously the children whose letters he answered were, that's still something that, despite what he may have been skimming off the top, there was still good to come out of this effort compared to, say, if he had been pulling a complete Ponzi scheme. There was something slightly more noble, I guess, about the Santa Claus Association, even as it kind of played on the emotions and generosity of New Yorkers.
Well, Alex, this has been a great discussion. And I, if you're listening to this, go out and get this book. It's a great Christmas time read. Where can people learn more about your book, about the book and your work?
Yeah, well, my website is alexpalmerwrites.com, where you can read about updates on the book and all kinds of other news on it. And it's available in most bookstores, certainly Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and any independent bookstore as well. It should be available there. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You guys, Alex Palmer, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and have a Merry Christmas.
Thanks a lot. You too, Brett. Take care.
My guest today was Alex Palmer. He's the author of the book, The Santa Claus Man. It's available on Amazon.com. Go check it out. Great Christmas time read. You'll learn a lot about the history of Christmas in America today. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/Santa Claus, where you find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. As always, we appreciate your reviews on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us out a lot. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.